Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, we'll be exploring the topic of mushrooms, and I am delighted to be speaking with Daniel Winkler, an expert in the fungi of the Northwest United States and the art of mushrooming. Not only is he an expert in the Northwest United States, but he guides mushrooming adventure tours internationally. Welcome, Daniel. Can you tell us more about yourself?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Well, what should I start with? I love mushrooms, maybe. And I love to share my love for mushrooms and do that enthusiastically. I grew up in a family that was mushroom hunting. Nobody would have called themselves a mycologist or anything. It was just part of being outdoors, you know, picking forest strawberries and blackberries and mushrooms when they were around and enjoying them, cooking them, and not worried that we gamble our life, you know, as it is so common in countries that are dominated by a fungophobe culture. Our British heritage in here, mushrooms are evil, and, you know, and you put each time you enjoy a mushroom, you put your life on the line, which is total nonsense. I mean, the most dangerous part of mushroom hunting is, if you have to drive to the forest. And once in the forest, no mushroom is going to jump on you. You are in total control. And yes, you can be stupid, as you can be always in life. And you can have the right amount of respect and really enjoy finding treasures in the forest and feeding yourself and doing something we've been doing since time immemorial. I mean, every animal forages. Yes, we got distracted by going out in supermarkets and foraging in strange places where there's definitely more dangerous toxins waiting for us in every supermarket. But we don't say, don't go in a supermarket, there's deadly chemicals, you know. Even the food additives, you know, where we are all guinea pigs. Yeah, we have a couple of mushrooms where we don't know what happens if you eat it all the time, or we know you eat them all the time and it can be dangerous, but we have so many mushrooms we can eat without a second thought and which are really not difficult to identify. You know, yeah, you got to put a little bit of time into it. But me as an immigrant watching American football, I have no idea in the beginning of what's going on there. And you got to put some time into it or not, you know, but it's...
We had a recent mushroom hike with some folk. We had 55 people and people were terrified of the mushrooms. We even had some people picking them up with gloves.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know the difference between poisonous and venomous. And you have to put in you, venomous, the snake bites you. They are fine to handle as long as you don't eat them. And as you're saying, so many are fine. That reminds me, you know, my audience, you know, they have a wide range of expertise levels. Some don't know the difference between mushroom and fungi.
Which is excusable.
Right. Can you explain it to us really quickly?
Yeah. So fungi is a much bigger group. These are all the organisms that we classify in the kingdom of fungi, which is... In the old days, till 1969, were part of the kingdom of plants, but it turns out that was a misconception. They're closer related to animals than to plants. And this contains all kinds of microscopic organisms, many evolutionary branches of fungi, most people never ever think about in their lives. And then we have a couple groups of fungi that grow mushrooms, as we call their fruiting bodies, we can see and that say find and appreciate. So the mushroom is organ of a fungus to produce its spores. And of course, the easiest if they do that above ground, because then we can see them, but some of them grow their fruiting bodies, their mushrooms underground, like truffle-like fungi. So that's the big difference between fungus and mushroom.
Okay, I've heard some people even compare it to an apple on a tree. The mushroom we see is the apple. And when you pick the apple, you didn't kill the tree.
Right. That's such a good analogy. Also, the relation of the size, you know, that the mycelium is the body, the tree of the fungus is much bigger than the mushroom, the apple, the fruit of the mycelium. And also, it tells us already something about sustainability. Picking mushrooms is very sustainable, as is picking apples, because as long as we don't hurt the tree, that's what these fruits are for. They are produced to spread seeds, spores, and taking them, moving them around, eating them, sharing them back with the environment is part of the function of a mushroom fruiting body. And of course, that only applies, you know, if if not every single apple or every single mushroom disappears before they can grow their seeds or spores.
As we were talking earlier, a lot of people are afraid of them. And as a biologist, I was wondering, I know when animals are venomous or poisonous, usually in nature, animals have one defense or another. So a tiger would have claws and teeth. A tiger does not need to be poisonous or venomous because that teeth and claws are its defense. But for other animals that don't have another defense, poison and venom are often used, you know, like the poison arrow frog eats poisonous ants, and that's how it gets its poison. Why are some mushrooms poisonous and so poisonous they could be lethal, and some are not at all, and they're in fact beneficial to us? It would make me think that some mushrooms have more to protect if they actually have poison. Is there any kind of theory about that you've ever heard?
There's not a conclusive theory. It doesn't seem to be about protecting yourself as a mushroom, because even if a mammal eats you or a slug eats you, you know, invertebrates or whatever, that's helpful for the mushroom to spread the spores. I think the best explanation, and actually some of these really toxic mushrooms, other animals have selected for them, that these toxins can be neutralized in their digestive system. So it's specific to the animal that eats the mushroom if these toxins are dangerous or not. In general, the mushrooms are really chemical powerhouses. They do the ecosystem services they do in breaking down biomass in, you know, the saprobic mushroom that feed on dead wood, on dead leaves, break down complex chemicals, molecules that were invented by the plants to give stability and to be long lasting. And then the mushrooms had to figure out, how do I get to these sugars, these polysaccharides? How can I break them up? And that's where, you know, a wide range of enzymes and other molecules are really important to break down that stuff. And in that process, by inventing all kinds of useful chemicals, yeah, some of them turn out to be dangerous, and we have not selected for them by developing defense. And also, as you pointed out, animals, you know, can run away, and plants and mushrooms cannot run away. Mm-hmm. But there's a big difference. Plants have a bark, plants have many layer of protective, you know, cuticle or whatever on their leaves, and fungi, the main organism underground, made out of these fine threads, the hyphae that make up the mycelium, each hyphae is one cell after the other. So only one cell, which is hollow, which is tubular, because inside water, nutrients, genes, cells, whatever move inside them, move back and forth in both directions at the same time. So while we have all these layers that protect us from the environment, and we also monitor what goes into our system, if we have a little bit of common sense, meaning read your labels in the supermarket. If there is too much you don't know, just don't eat that stuff. And of course, the same applies to organisms in nature. If you don't know what it is, and if you don't know it is edible and harmless, do not eat it. So the mushrooms can't run away, but what they have is an incredible immune system. And this immune system, you know, when you are that exposed underground, where there's millions of other organisms who all are after your protein, and mushrooms in the dry state, so 90% of a fruiting body is water, but the 10% that are not water, out of this, there's about 30-40% protein. And also in the mycelium, there's lots of protein in the cell walls and so on. And everybody wants that. And the mushrooms defend themselves through incredible strong immune systems, which makes them so interesting as medicinals for us. And many of them really have these antibacterial, antiviral, anti-whatever microorganism powers, and really can also support our immune system. And then there's a few tricksters like cordyceps-related fungi. These are insect parasites that overcome the immune system of insects and then digest the insects. And so they have a whole different toolbox of tricking an immune system. And some of them have been turned into very important, powerful drugs, like cyclosporin is derived from a cordyceps, from tulipocladium, and also gelenia, which is MS drug, is also derived from a cordyceps. And, you know, these are really important drugs. There was no successful organ transplantations before cyclosporin was used that then enabled 80 to 90% of survival rate, while before that was used, there was like an 80 to 90% death rate with organ transplants, or at least, yeah, the organs wouldn't be taken. So in this regard, mushrooms are absolutely fascinating. Everybody knows about penicillinum, which is a fungus, and it's not just very helpful as an antibiotic, but we have also two species of penicillinum that make awesome cheese. Penicillinum camembertii makes camembert, and Penicillium roqueforti, guess what that does? That does blue cheese. Yeah. So, I mean, isn't that crazy how, you know, Penicillium has these aspects, and eating mushrooms is a really healthy thing. And we have research out of Singapore, 2019, Lai Fang, who just had people eat mushrooms twice a week. And he said doing that, the onset of mild cognitive impairment was reduced by 50% just having two portions of mushrooms a week. So don't even really know all the good stuff, you know, that mushrooms can do for us, because in the Western world, especially English speaking world, fungophobia, you know, it's not just that parents freak out when kids touch mushrooms and wash your hands, don't put them in your mouth. But it's also that there is not enough research funding going into these applicational things of mushrooms. Yes, for fungal biodiversity, researching the fungi of a certain area, flora, fauna, fungi. So the collective of fungal species in an area, especially, let's say, in the tropics, you can get funding. But to look for specific toxins in mushrooms, or also just general health benefits, there's not enough funding. And in fungophile countries, cultures that love mushrooms, there's much more funding for that kind of research and much more knowledge. And that was part here when I wrote my book here on the edibles of the Pacific Northwest, Fruits of the Forest, is I incorporated a lot of information from research not happening in the English-speaking world. Right. And, you know, when it comes to edibility or toxins in mushrooms, there's just so much more known in Europe and in East Asia than there is in the English speaking world. So anyways, so eat your mushrooms, eat the right mushrooms. And of course, the greatest joy is if you know where to find them yourselves. And we are very lucky here in the Pacific Northwest. There is, I think we are the place which has the most abundance in choice edible mushrooms, and also where we have way less seriously toxic mushrooms, and also do hunt in an environment where we're not bothered by chiggers, snakes, and whatever, you know, things that can make mushroom hunting much more exciting than you want it to be.
You mentioned that most of the mushroom is under the ground. Tell me about that. Tell me how they contribute to environmental balance. I've heard some people talk about, we have really, really tall Douglas fir trees out here. And I also understand in other countries, they have super tall eucalyptus trees. And I understand that these trees would not reach the growth they have without mushrooms, because their root structure is not as effective as it would need to be to support their height without the assistance of mushrooms that can reach way down in the soil and way down in nooks and crannies and whatnot, and feed them water and other kind of things that they need to survive. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. So you mentioned here Douglas firs and eucalyptus, and these are two trees in families that are ectomycorrhizal, which means root associated. And that means that the root, the mycelium goes to the root, and the root has a special little organ which the mycelium grows around. And it's called the Hartig net, and that goes around these blunt root ends. And at this point, there's exchange happening. So the tree, able to do photosynthesis, produces mm-hmm. sugars. The mushroom and fungi cannot do photosynthesis. That's a big difference to plants. What they do, they are very good with their chemical powers to collect nutrients, to break down things. For example, mushrooms eat rock. So you might remember when you have turned over a rock and you see all that white mesh under that rock, the mycelium, that is not just hanging out there for no reason. No, that mycelium is cutting out nutrients out of that rock, like going for the magnesium or the phosphates or the nitrogen or whatever it can find in the rock that is lacking in the environment, the fungus will take. And the same thing happens when breaking down wood or biomass. These fungi pull out the nutrients and then offer the nutrients to the tree. And especially nitrogen and phosphates are supplied 80 to 100% by the fungus to the tree. And they even, you know, there's a trade. The tree pays back sugars in the amounts the fungus provides these minerals and nutrients to the tree. And there's competition as well. And there's even research that shows that these fungi will pull out free-floating phosphates or nitrogen in the ground, which the trees could access through their roots. The fungus will pull out and keep them in its mycelium to drive up the price of these nutrients by making them more rare. So I think we see there's an ego in fungi, just is there in all the animals and in us humans. And as we have seen in research and plants, that there's always that self-interest, that me, me, me first, and then my family, and then, okay, whatever happens around us. And sometimes we are smartly selfish, envying everything around us. So anyway, so this is really important. And you can grow a Douglas fir without a root-associated fungus, but they never will reach that size and they cannot compete. And in the environment, there is a wide range of these root-associated fungi, and that will be always there to work with the tree. The hypothesis is that when algae moved to the land and became plants, algae don't have root systems. And so you imagine that happened somewhere in the wetlands or interface of shore and above land. There was no plants on the land, but there was already fungi there, that these fungi teamed up with the algae and offered their system as root system. And the trees or the plants later on developed their root systems, but already have, after they had cooperated with the fungi, providing them water and nutrients. And we have two main groups of these root-associated fungi, fungal systems. So I mentioned the ectomycorrhizals, and these are, on the plant side, these are all the pine family, the beech family that includes oaks and chestnuts, also birch and poplars, and a whole range of others, but some in the leguminosae family. But in the northern hemisphere, for us, really important pine and oak or beech family. And then much more prevalent or having more partners are the arbuscular mycorrhizals. So these are a smaller group of fungi, none of them that we like to eat. They're too small, especially in the Glomeratacea family. And they, for example, when it comes to plants, to trees, they team up with anything on the redwood juniper side, the cypress family, and the maples, and most of the apples. But they also team up with most of the other plants. I think the number is like 85 to 90% of all the plants have these arbuscular mycorrhizals, which is what nature did also with all the grasses out there. And one of our big crimes in agriculture is that we completely ignored this ancient cooperation between arbuscular fungi and grains. And with fertilizers and fungicides and all these things we came up with, which on first impression seem also great, but we completely ignored nature's approach for millions of years and keeping plowing our fields and putting all these toxins on there. The arbuscular mycorrhizal have an extremely hard time, and they store incredible amounts of carbon underground. So the whole carbon statistics had to be redone some years ago when it was realized what immense amounts of carbon is stored in the form of hyphae, of mycelium underground. And modern agriculture completely ignores that, which is a great pity and really sad, you know. And it's something we got to go back to. We got to integrate these fungi again in our agriculture to get the carbon underground again. I mean, agriculture is one of our main issues with carbon in the atmosphere. It's modern agriculture that releases incredible amounts, and it is politically, nobody wants to talk about it because it's toxic, you know, to bring that up because it's so fundamental for us, and it's not nice to blame agriculture for that. But, you know, that's why supporting organic agriculture, regenerative agriculture is really crucial at that point. If you can afford it, do it. This is so much better for our carbon footprint when we feed ourselves with stuff that really realizes building soil is crucial, and fungi, carbon, fungal carbon underground is a big part of it.
This is fascinating. Talking to laymen, and I teach a lot of children. Children think that mushrooms come from the grocery store and that they are a plant, as you mentioned, because they don't move and they look kind of like a plant. But your point being exactly that they're not a plant. They're more like an animal and that they have to go get their food. They can't make their food through photosynthesis. Like we have to go to the grocery store. They can't make their food either. But you say they work in partnership with plants and trees to provide for them. Well, they borrow from the plants and trees to get food from them and then feed back nutrients.
Absolutely.
And the plants and trees, of course, getting their nutrients from the sun through the photosynthesis, and they're feeding the mushrooms. So this is fascinating. Many people I know think mushrooms grow in caves in fertilizer. They have no idea how little they see when they look into the forest. They may see a fruiting body of the mushroom, which of course is what we see. They have no idea about the life going on underground. Is there a way to evaluate your forest health, especially with us out here in the Northwest, by looking at our forest? Is there a way that the mushrooms kind of indicate the valuable information to us about our environment?
Oh, absolutely. But the main problem is that we lack so much baseline information, you know, that we have done, how much research is done on our vegetation, on our plants, on indicator species, and, you know, the plant communities and so on, which gives us a lot of information where we can right away say this is oak growth, even if it's not about the size of the trees, but the species composition. And when it comes to our mushrooms, we do know a certain amount of mushrooms we basically only find in oak growth forest, or which are much more common in oak growth forest when we talk about edible mushrooms, our cauliflower mushrooms, Borassus radicata, beautiful big mushroom, you know, that is a root parasite and quite common in oak growth forest. And if we find it in our plantation forests, often it's around old stumps. Same with agaricon, very important medicinal mushroom, also used by native people, carving figurines out of it, used for millennia back in Europe as well. Ancient Greeks were importing it from these days Ukraine. And the name agaricon is for the people who live there. And then it was applied to all the agaricus and so on, which is a whole different group of mushrooms. But these big polypores that are growing over many years, old growth Douglas firs, that's where we find them here. And of course, what are we down to? We lost 93% of our old growth forest out here. So this has hit a whole bunch of mushrooms, or our biggest mushroom out here, Bridgeoporus nobilissimus, which can have a diameter of 3-4 feet on the base. It's a polypore again, one of these congs, these shelf fungi, and it's very hairy on top. And we keep the sites secret when we find them. We share them with some researchers, but the idea that just somebody comes and takes it as a trophy home where there's hardly anything left. So, and there's even regular mushrooms like Phaeocolybia. They are much more common in oak growth forest, and you hardly find many of these species in the plantation forest. But luckily for us mushroom hunters, chanterelles are very happy in plantations. And even when we look at our, you know, Douglas fir plantations, lowland, western lowland Douglas fir plantations from a biodiversity perspective, it is heartbreaking. But as a mushroom hunter, at least we get our chanterelles in such abundance in these forests. Of course, you might get lucky and pick in a spot for 10, 15 years and then comes logging. And, you know, our biggest problem picking mushrooms is sustainable in places where people are obsessed with certain mushrooms, like Italy and porcini. I mean, it is crazy to see how the Italians love that mushroom. It's still around after millennia. The key is having the habitat. And this is one of the main problems, is habitat loss, which of course often is, at this point, it's logging and it is paving over nature and spread of human habitation. And then on top to that challenge, climate change, where we see that changes in precipitation, in temperatures, affect certain fungi, but also trees. Like we have the die-off now of lowland abies, of true firs, because it's been too dry and too hot in the summers. Certain areas, the cedars, the red cedars are hit. And that will then also undermine their partners, the fungi that work specifically with Abies. And some of these root-associated mushrooms are very specific to their host. You only find them with Abies, with true firs, or you only find them with Douglas firs, pseudotsuga, or you find them specifically with spruce. And yes, some are generalists that work with whoever is around. And, you know, they can go between pine family and the oak family back and forth. Some of them, you know, open to much wider corporations than others. And losing the trees, we will lose these mushrooms. And we had a very interesting scenario, well-researched in Europe with acid rain, that especially was problematic on sandy soils. And it hit certain mushrooms that would disappear. And first people would think, okay, it's the pollution that kills the mushroom. But the reality was the phosphates and the nitrogen that was brought in by pollution, the trees could access that directly with their roots. They didn't need the fungus anymore to get that out of rock or wherever in the soil. And the tree said, sorry, my fungal partners, I get that stuff now for free. I'm not going to buy it from you anymore. So that was a total hit on root-associated mushrooms. And, you know, many of them is really what we love to eat, the boletes, the chanterelles, tsutake, the russulas, the brittle gills, corals. Cordinarius is a huge group. So these ectomycorrhizal, huge, many of our big mushrooms, big fruiting bodies are these ectomycorrhizals. And with that pollution then, you know, it got much better because we have all these filters now, not for carbon, unfortunately, yet, but the mushrooms lost out in the trade.
Wow, this is fascinating. Let me let our listeners know, for our guests just tuning in, this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with mushroom expert Daniel Winkler. This is fascinating, Daniel. This is a hidden world that I think so few people know about. What are the challenges when you go mushrooming? Can you give us some rules of the trade? What do you need to watch out for? What do you look for?
Well, the first thing is, don't get lost. Okay. Yeah. We have lots of help these days. If you use GPS, make sure you have enough batteries, because if you rely on technology and you have no power, you're screwed. Know how well your orientation works. Besides that, finding mushrooms, we talked a lot about the tree associated mushrooms. So you should know the habitat where mushrooms will show up. And if a book tells you, or if you know, this mushroom grows with Douglas firs, well, go where Douglas firs grow. If that tree is specific to growing on dying alders, well, if there's no alders, that mushroom will not show up in a conifer forest. You should have a rough idea about, if you go for specific mushrooms, what is their habitat? And seasonality is really crucial. So mushrooms, like apples, have a season of fruiting. And for them, the two key factors is temperature and moisture availability. Here in the Pacific Northwest, most areas in the Northern Hemisphere have their mushroom season in summer. Early spring, early summer, the trees use the sugars they produce to grow their wood. But once they did the early wood, then they start sharing their sugars. And that's when the mushroom put out their fruiting bodies. The mycelium is around all year round, works for the tree all year round, but the fruiting bodies come out when for the ectomycorrhizal, the root-associated mushrooms, where there's the extra amount of sugar available for the trees. Now, we lack summer rains here. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have the thunderstorms, we don't have a monsoon. We have this Mediterranean climate up here, summer drought, winter rains. And so we have to wait till we have good rains. And often for us, that means October. The rains come back, hopefully at some time in September. And then it always takes several weeks for the boletes and the chanterelles and so to really fruit when the rains are back. So it's not, it's going to rain and you have your mushroom the next day. You know, it can be several weeks. And so seasonality is really important. And you got to spend your time out in the woods. And of course, the first thing is you just, whenever you're out in nature, just look for mushrooms. And whatever time you spend looking at mushrooms is helpful. Even if you don't succeed attaching a name to it, you still see things. You still train your eyes, your perception, that helps you identifying mushrooms. And it's just a skill we have to learn, just like people learn identifying cars. And sadly, so many more five-year-olds can tell you how many car models, but when you ask them about trees, you know, it's already a sad story. Of course, the safety aspect is you never should eat a mushroom. You are not 100% sure what it is. And don't take it lightly. And even most of our mushrooms are harmless, but maybe a dozen out here are deadly. And then maybe there's 100, 150 that make you quite sick, maybe even more. But if you don't know what it is and you start feeling strange and sick, it's really scary. If you feel sick after eating a mushroom where you were told it causes such phenomena, well, that's what I was told that's going to happen. And you have the information if it's deadly or not, right? If there is serious damage to your organs. An upset stomach, if this is what you're happy to gamble with, okay, fine. But if you're not sure what mushroom you ate, this will really teach you a lesson. And interestingly, you can taste any mushroom as long as you don't swallow. I use my sense of taste, my smell, how do mushrooms feel, the consistency. It's not just the color and the shape, you know, like what we get from pictures. Really important, because that's what we all trained for, just to look at things and identify them. When you start using your smell and your taste and feeling the texture and the structure of the mushroom flesh, it is so helpful. And I really encourage everybody always taste the mushrooms, smell the mushrooms. And yes, some don't have, many don't have no specific taste and no specific odor besides fungal, but many of them also really will reveal themselves to you by matching color, shape, and taste or odor. And then you feel just so much safer. It is so much easier than to identify when you use these different senses, and also a great way to learn. And if you're new to identifying a mushroom, you know, you can pick them, you can identify them, you can smell them, you taste them with spitting out, but you don't need to eat it as well. You can first get familiar with something, especially with mushrooms where there's warnings that it's not a beginner's mushroom. So in my book, Fruits of the Forest, I call them the 14 fantastic fungi. So these are mushrooms that are fairly easy to identify. They don't have deadly lookalikes. One or two of them might have a footnote. You got to see how you react to them, especially like morels, which are very easy to identify. But some people get a reaction to it. And when you start eating a mushroom, you have to see, am I one of the unfortunate people who get an allergic reaction? The beauty with mushrooms, it's always the mushroom's fault. Everybody always blames the mushroom. And it's not like peanuts where it's the people's fault when they get a poisoning. No, with the mushrooms, it's always the mushroom's fault. Figure that out. How do you react to it? So don't overindulge in the beginning. Just eat a couple forks of something and then continue the next day or maybe 2 hours later or something. And with that, you are very safe. Yeah, so the 14 fantastic fungi, you know, these are things like our morels, chanterelles, the kingboletes, the cauliflower mushroom, the lion's mane or bear's head, you know, many of them easy to identify, and only very few gilt mushrooms. I would include the Lactarius, the saffron milk caps are very safe to identify. Also the shaggy manes. And also I put the oysters in there when you stay above 4 inches diameter for the fruiting bodies, and you know, whitish in clusters on wood, you're very safe. And so, you know, it's really, people can be happy mushroom hunters their whole life and just basically foraging morels in spring and then chanterelles and boletes in fall and maybe chicken of the woods sulfur shelf in the summer when we're hiking, you know, when the rains are not really bad, but these wood decaying mushrooms already react quickly on wood. And you don't have to worry much about terminology and can live a happy life as a mushroom hunter without ever having done a spore print, which is something that's very helpful when you deal with gilt mushrooms and where we have most of our deadly mushrooms, gilt mushrooms. And interestingly, a whole bunch of the deadly ones do have a ring. So they have a little piece of tissue around the stem. It's also called the partial veil, because before the mushroom open up, it covers the gills. And then when the cap expands, that tissue drops down and it remains a ring around the stem. And the death cap has a ring and the deadly Galerinus has a trace of a ring and Foliotina has a pronounced ring. So the best is if you want to collect guild mushrooms, you got to put time into it. And, you know, there's so much stuff to be found before you're really challenged, seriously challenged with identification skills. We are so lucky these days. We have great books out in the Pacific Northwest for mushroom identification. When I moved here in 1995 from Germany, there was very few mushroom books out there. And, you know, there was still lots of black and white out there, only a few color picture mushrooms like the mushroom savory. And yes, there was the Audubon mushrooms of North America, but that was a torture because most of the mushrooms didn't grow here. And you spend hours going through the pictures and, oh yeah, that's a match. And then, no, this is only Arkansas to Maine, not out here. Get a regional mushroom guide. And we have a whole range of good ones out here, excellent books. And in all humbleness, I can really recommend my book, The Fruits of the Forest, because my focus is edible mushrooms. So I have 180 species of edible mushrooms. Some of them maybe not edible in the sense that everybody feels like I have to do a bit of kitchen alchemy to eat that mushroom. Or their lookalikes are really poisonous. Why would I go there? But, you know, I mentioned that and I let people know about the lookalikes, what is the risks, or if there is very low risk, and then also how to work with them. Because a lot of mushrooms, like we have all these swillers, jacks, these are boletes, they're so abundant, and Eastern Europe, people love them. They have a really great taste. However, if you just fry them up in butter or in oil, they get totally mushy, and it kills it. If you dry them and powder them, that's a great way to use them. But a key thing to enjoy a whole bunch of mushrooms, especially soft tissue mushrooms or mushrooms that have been out in the rain for 3 weeks, like late season chanterelles, is dry frying. So when you fry your mushrooms, don't start out with oil or butter in your frying pan. Just slice them up, put them in the frying pan. Don't put too much of them in there, and then let them release their water. And that water you can save for making a sauce if there's a whole bunch of it. And once they start sticking to the frying pan, then you add your butter and your oil. And in the case of the jacks, the swillers, at that point, they have released a lot of water. They have contracted. Their structure improved. Their taste can shine now. And then you fry them up and you have a really pleasant mushroom, which you wonder how come people are down on that mushroom. So the dry frying is crucial for a lot of mushrooms. So I have all these tips in the book, and I have out of the 400 pages, 50 pages are recipes where I try to get the most out of it while keeping it simple too, because there's tons of great complex recipes out there and I want to do a middle ground. And also often I just make suggestions how you integrate the mushrooms in other recipes you already know or you can find everywhere else, because that's a big part of edible mushrooms is how do you work with them? How do you process them? How do you keep them? Which ones are good for drying? Like chanterelles and king boletes are awesome for drying. When you put them in the sun, you will charge them with vitamin D. Mushrooms have cholesterol in their cell walls. And if you put that out in the sunlight, it will turn in vitamin D. Same process as for us when we get out in the sun. The great news about mushrooms is like morels in spring or spring kings in when we have lots of sunshine, it's a little hard to do that in November or October when we don't have much sunshine and the sun doesn't have as much power. But if we happen to pick mushrooms in late spring or in summer, dry them first in the sun and you charge them with vitamin D. The more surface you have exposed, the more vitamin D will you get. And then you can finish in your drying in a dryer and make them crisp. Once they crisp and make a sound, you break them, then they're dry enough and you put them in an airtight jar or so in a dark spot. You don't have to freeze them, but you can do that too. And a whole bunch of mushrooms, we have the idea that they even get better through the years when you keep them. But you got to make sure you dry them properly and store them very dry and in a container where insects can't get into it.
That is so cool. I had no idea about the powering up with vitamin D. That's fascinating. Yeah. It's made me think of a couple things. My son is a forager and he always puts a mushroom or something like that to his lip.
Yeah.
He knows some stuff, but probably not as much as he should. But he always puts it to his lip to see if it's going to be tingly or stingy or something. And the other thing that made me think about, as a herpetologist, when we ID venomous snakes, they say, like you said, don't go by one feature. Try all your senses to ID the mushroom. Same thing with snakes. We're not told to ID because it has a slit eye or a triangle head or a black tongue or whatever the features may be that people look for. They say that won't work with any one snake, that you need to use four or five features to positively ID it as a venomous snake.
Right.
Same thing you're saying about mushrooms. Use several features to ID.
Like in my book, if it can work with a handful of features, I always have that introduction about a mushroom. And this is really, that's what, you know, the safe or the easy to identify mushrooms. You can work with a handful of criteria. Other more complex ones, you know, when you have a list of 10 checkpoints or so, because you need to differentiate it from other mushrooms, that's much more complex. Right. But yes, that's the lucky thing is when we have 3 or 4 points and they say, okay, you got the mushroom. Yes, you never can go by one thing. For example, we have these really tasty white chanterelles, mm-hmm. and which are much more common when it gets a little bit drier. So out towards western side of the Cascades, towards the Pacific, we have all these golden chanterelles. There's no place on this earth that has as many chanterelles as we have and as big as they are. So we are really lucky. And the golden chanterelle with the color, with the apricot odor, with the rubbery texture, with these gill-like folds that run outside down. We call it decurrent, like a river running down. And then the cup shape, you know, of the mushroom. That's all you got to know for a chanterelle. But that color is so helpful. Now, the white chanterelles, there's a whole bunch of gilt white mushrooms that look very similar to a white chanterelle. So as a beginner, once you know the golden chanterelle, you can easily make the leap to the white chanterelle. Mm-hmm. But if you're new to mushroom hunting, the white chanterelle is not a safe mushroom to start because there's a whole bunch of white mushrooms that are much more tricky. You know, if you stay with that decurrent feature of the folds running down the stem and the chalice-like shape, it's already much safer. But when people get new to something, you know, they have such a different perception than when you have dealt with something. And luckily, I do remember, you know, and for me, moving from Europe here to the Pacific Northwest, I had to question my mushroom knowledge because I'm in a new locality. I had no idea, is there dangerous, toxic mushrooms? I had no idea about in Europe. For me, it was very helpful to see, even already having collected mushrooms for 25 years when I moved here in 95, it was very helpful to see the challenges when, you know, books tell you, oh, watch out, there's this California agaricus, you know, that just looks like the meadow mushroom or the horse mushroom, but that one upsets your digestive system, which anybody who uses David Aurora's Whatever the Rain Promises gets scared about using agaricus because of the mentioning of the California agaricus, which turns out by now is absolutely rare. It was never a big deal in the Pacific Northwest anyways, which also makes the point that a field guide, the more regional, the better, the easier it is for you. David is ever going to rewrite, update the book. The warning will never sound like that. But this really scared me for many years. And I mm-hmm. keep still seeing it, how people get scared by information that is dated. Part of it, well, it's agricultural practices, too many nutrients are being brought out, which kills these mushrooms, and also climate change. You know, it's an evolving thing. Things are changing and we have to pay attention. One of my favorite edibles are the shaggy parasols, chlorophyllum. Out here in the Pacific Northwest, we were very safe. We had three species, big mushrooms with shaggy, scaly caps and looking a lot like toxic amanitas, but the big difference is when you scratch them, they turn orange, salmon colored. And this we don't have in any of our toxic amanitas in the Pacific Northwest. Different when you're out in Texas or on the East Coast. Very fine. And there is another chlorophyllum, the green sport, shaggy parasol, which is really toxic. Doesn't kill people, but, you know, 3 days of intensive care. You don't wish that on anybody. And at least in Europe, you don't worry about the hospital bills because everybody has health insurance. Out here, you got to worry about that point instead of feeling absolutely miserable. And, you know, I talked to people who wouldn't eat mushrooms for 5 years after having that poisoning. And we didn't have that mushroom here. But with climate change, it moved up. So it's still very rare. And we have a report from Walla Walla and the Willamette Valley, but also in the Seattle area, supposedly it showed up. And so now when you collect your shaggy parasols, you got to make sure, especially if you think you found one of them in a meadow. They tend to grow in meadows and they like hot climate. So they're not a fall mushroom, but they are. I found some sources that said that was number one toxic mushroom in the United States. But for us, it wasn't around here. And now it's popping up. Small numbers. So, you know, you got to stay on top. It's really with the mushroom, the newer the books, the better they are. It's because we also as a community have learned so much more. And also when you have your look at our local mycological societies, or less glamorous, we can call them our mushroom clubs here. So many people come from different cultures there and also bring their mushroom knowledge and their enthusiasm, you know, because traditional American culture informed by British fungophobia, people were just so scared of mushrooms and wouldn't dare to pick mushrooms without being part of such a club. And if I would still live in Germany, I probably never would have joined a mushroom club there. That just seems absurd, you know. Why do I need a club if I go in the forest pick mushrooms? I'm so happy I did that here. When I moved here in 95, I joined the Puget Sound Mycological Society and volunteered there and still volunteer there. And I mean, it has benefited me so much. I learned so much and also love to share my knowledge there. And we have classes there. And so we have so many mycological societies in the Pacific Northwest. And especially if you a little bit more careful about mushroom and more worried, join the local club. And you can also use the internet for help. You know, on Facebook, we have these like Pacific Northwest Mushroom Identification Forum or other groups where you can upload your mushroom pictures and ask for identification help. Never go with the first person who tells you what you have there. There's a lot of enthusiastic people who are new to it and who might misidentify your mushrooms. Wait till you have a couple people agreeing on an identification. So it's so much easier now to go out mushroom hunting than it was 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago here. The flip side of the coin is that there used to be so many more easily accessible edible mushrooms. And just here myself as part of PSMS and going to all these mushroom events, I mean, I taught thousands of people, all my competition, right? But we have such extensive forests. And yes, I can't just hop in a car, drive 30 minutes from Seattle and come home with 30 pounds of chanterelles anymore without walking long distance. And I also learned these big amounts are just a bit of a curse because, you know, I'm not just selling my mushrooms. I process them, I cook and freeze and so on, or I dry them. And there's always the thought, okay, it's so much fun picking them, but you got to also process them. And then you also got to use them up. And which, of course, we love to share the mushrooms. And not surprisingly, you know, lots of my dried mushrooms turn into Christmas presents or birthday presents and whatever.
Tell me again the name of your book.
So the book is called Fruits of the Forest, A Field Guide to Pacific Northwest Edible Mushrooms. I wrote that during COVID, and I'm very happy if you order that from my website, mushrooming.com. We roam for mushrooms. I made up that word for my travel agency. Well, I am the travel agency, which means nice. These mushroom tours. At the moment, I do two tours a year to Colombia, South America, and Bhutan in the Himalayas. I also used to do Bolivia and Tibet. That's where I started it all out, because I used to work on environmental issues in Tibet till the Chinese government got way too hostile to work the way I do it. And so I'm very happy if you order that from my webpage. I'm happy to sign it to you. And I usually mail out within the same day or the next day, unless I happen to be somewhere in the woods or traveling for a weekend or something like that. And it really has the most information on our edibles. And I try to make it accessible for beginners, but I also try to have the science up for the expectations of any person that is deep into it. But Yes, the focus is edible mushrooms and a bunch of poisonous lookalikes. You're not going to find every mushroom out in the forest in there. We have other books, The Mushrooms of the Pacific Northwest, The Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast. There's a whole bunch of great field guides, which I'm all mentioning in my book as well. If you want to get into mushrooms, you know, one book is never enough. And then we have this great free software, Mycomatch, one of these socialist Canadian projects where people put out an awesome thing for free you can download. And we all in the mushroom community love contributing to it, sharing our pictures and, you know, what we have out there. A lot of information. It's really up to the person to, at this point, to find all these resources. I also made a whole bunch of little foldouts. One of them sold over 25,000 times. The Mushrooms of the Pacific Northwest. It's like a laminated foldout. And I did one for medicinal mushrooms and for California and the Amazon. And also have the bullet cards. So with Gary Gilbert, 53 cards where we have all our most common bullets, and 95% of our bullets or 90% are edibles, and some of the best edibles are bullets. These are the mushrooms with a spongy fertile tissue under the cap. Some of them getting really big, like the king bullets, the porcini, and easy to identify. So, you know, I made a card set like 4x6 tarot card style so you can train yourself. And yeah, so I love producing educational material, all stuff which I said, that would have been awesome if that was out when I got here in 95. Right. This is all the questions I had, you know, what do we have out here? How edible is it? How do you have, you know, some people say it's toxic. Other people say, oh no, it's a great edible. I've been eating that for 50 years. What are you talking about? So in my book, I bring up all these sides. It's not like, hey, it's for you to decide. These are people's experiences. And yes, we don't have the solid double-blind studies on every mushroom out there. No, it's not. It's really, what's really nice in the mushroom community is how many lay people contribute fundamentally important to science, and how many of the professional mycologists are also willing to embrace the lay community. And also how dependent they are on the lay community to feed them, you know, to bring them the mushrooms, to show them mushrooms they might never have seen, they've been looking for. So it's a really fertile exchange and a very fluid transition of lay community and professional community.
That's fantastic. One more concern about out here. I was warned to be careful where you mushroom, because people get very possessive and defensive of their hidden properties and their special places to look, and that it can almost be dangerous when you go out in the woods and you don't know exactly where you're going. If you go on someone's property or a property that someone has kind of claimed as their own hunting ground. Have you run into that issue?
I never felt threatened. Yes, there's stories out there. Of course, when somebody comes up to me and says, this is my spot, I said, what are you talking about? This is my spot. So, you know, I mean, as long as we on, you know, let's say state forest grounds or whatever, we are even allowed to pick mushrooms in the national forest out. Okay. Our, you know, Mount Rainier and Olympic Peninsula and North Cascades, you're allowed to take a gallon of mushrooms for personal use. Usually we all think national parks, you can't take anything, but we have these really supportive regulations here that you, when you're out there on a camping trip, you can feed yourself and you can take a little bit home too. And, you know, there was these stories about when Matsutake collection, the white pine mushroom, the Japanese are crazy about and the Europeans ignored and even disdained when they first found it and called it the nauseous amylaria. And yes, there was some turf wars. But when you look at when there was serious crimes in connection with mushroom hunting, it was usually about two males and a female. And so it wasn't about the mushroom. And yes, it would be a better place if people didn't have guns. No doubt about that. Having grown up in a place where hardly anybody has guns, you just feel safer. You know, maybe the best teaching is in a gun-obsessed culture is as a male, you can relate a little bit to female fear of males around you, because also the males are dangerous to the males here through the guns. But you got to find your spots, and your spots, of course, the easier the access, the closer to the highway, the closer to where you pull over, the more likely somebody else sees your spot too. And the more you leave your traces by, you know, when you trim your mushrooms in the forest, which I love to do, and you leave the traces visible, of course, somebody might not find your mushrooms, but they found your spot. And they say, oh, look, somebody cleaned their bullets here. Well, let me come earlier next year so I beat the person to their spot. Also, it's just so nice if you don't let other people know that you already took what they're looking for. It's really nice not to, you know, litter the forest with your trimmings. And we have some sad stories that some foragers get lost, disappear. But in general, the chances are very slim, and use your common sense and always best to team up. My spot, your spot, you know, if it's common property, if it's not private property, that doesn't really hold up. And there is apps out there that show you exactly the boundaries between private lands and forest and state forests, you know, hunting apps that work very well for mushroom hunting as well, and so on. There's a lot of help out there to steer clear from trouble like that. And as somebody told me, you know, it's always great. And thing we like to do is remove trash from the forest. And if you happen up by chance on a private forest area and you happen to have some cans or bottles or these obnoxious balloons that drift into the forest, you happen to have them hanging from your backpack or in your basket, I'm sure any forest owner sees you clean up their forest will approach you very different than when you're just taking the good mushrooms.
Daniel, that's beautiful. This has been wonderful. You are a wealth of information. I am so excited that I found you and met you, and I am so grateful for your time. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for your insight and your wisdom.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm just so happy that the people discover mushrooms and, you know, that they just don't get vilified anymore. And even the word mushrooming, you know, when I started my mushrooming in 2007 for my eco mushroom travels, I had no idea how negatively the word mushrooming was, because in my world, you know, mushrooming was great. And then I Googled it and it's like, yeah, it's people settling where they should be settling than mushrooming. And by now I've realized it has changed. Now the word mushrooming is even used in a positive context just to express how strong things are growing. So even in the
use of
word mushrooming, there has been a transition, and the English speaking world is catching up with many other parts of the world, realizing that mushrooms are not our enemies. And yes, we got to be careful, but they can enrich our lives and in such a beautiful way, and also make more of us get out in nature, become stewards of nature, and, you know, stand up for habitat protection. And that's so important. So it connecting to nature through mushrooms is really powerful and will make more people stand up for nature. And we just have as a society to realize that we are nature too, and we need nature. And this whole idea that nature goes somewhere else and we are over here doesn't work in the long run. We got to be rooted in nature and live in nature and find ways to be much closer to nature, and using mushrooms industrially as well, you know, moving away from styrofoams and from plastics and also animal hides, and use mushrooms for that is just a great contribution. And luckily, eating mushrooms, you know, it's not like these nasty vegetarians who kill a carrot or a beet and eat the whole thing. No, we just pick the fruit and leave the organism keep going on. And it's such an alternative to eating meat. It's really important. It has all the amino acid, it's full of protein, minerals, vitamins. Carbon footprint is so much smaller. I don't see any culinary sacrifice switching meat for mushrooms. As a whole society, you know, we really got to do that, because we all want to survive and we got to just compromise. It's a really sweet, nice compromise, eating more mushrooms and less meat.
Daniel, this is wonderful. This is great. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and I've been speaking with Daniel Winkler, mushroom expert and mushrooming ecotour guide. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you could find past episodes at umquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.